That was quite beautiful. When Rita first talked to me about, you know, her doing this up here, when I heard it was a song entitled, you know, had Celtic in the title, it's like, that sounds good to me. I love Celtic music. And that was beautiful. Thanks. A long time ago, there was a person who was born under death sentence. However, this person was chosen by God for a purpose. And God delivered the person in such a miraculous way that only God can, providing for him in the very household with the very family that had handed down the death sentence. Of course, by this time, you probably figured out I might be referring to Moses. We all know the story and what transpired after Moses grew up and the circumstances surrounding his exile from Egypt. I'd like to pick up the story today in Exodus 3, beginning in verse 1. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight. Why, the bush doesn't burn. So when the Lord saw that he had turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Now, we've seen this story many times. I've read it probably dozens, if not hundreds of times. And we read over it, and we take it at face value, and we probably don't think too deeply about it. Well, of course, Moses had to take his shoes off because God said, take your shoes off. This is holy ground. To appreciate all that this example has to offer us, we have to pause and we have to consider some things a little more deeply now. The first is, why did Moses have to remove his shoes? Now that sounds like an obviously silly question, doesn't it? But let me ask it along with another question. Why did Moses have to remove his shoes when in so many other instances of an appearance by God, didn't seem to be necessary? God appeared to Abraham, Jacob, Hagar, Gideon, just to name a few, 70 elders of Israel, a lot of people. So then why did he ask Moses to remove his shoes? Now, truth be told, maybe Abraham had his shoes off already. He was sitting in his entrance of his tent during the heat of the day, so maybe he was relaxing with his shoes off, and possibly Jacob had his shoes off already because he was taking his family over the brook Jabbok, remember, before he fought the angel. But I'm pretty sure Hagar would have had her shoes on out in the desert, Gideon had his, and probably most of the people had their shoes on, so why didn't God ask them? Even in later appearances of Moses, when God revealed far more of himself than he did in the burning bush, didn't seem like Moses had to remove his shoes from off his feet. Now the question becomes much more interesting, doesn't it? Is there something specific that we can learn here? Today, we'll work to answer this question. To do so, we're going to have to learn about how the people of that time viewed such concepts as holy ground, shoes, and even God. Because believe it or not, people of that day approached God and even other gods, not really gods, with far more reverence than people today do with the living God. So let's look at Exodus 3 again. God draws Moses to himself by means of a burning bush, something you don't see every day. Once Moses arrives, the first thing God does, even before introducing himself to Moses, he asks Moses to remove his shoes. Now, it's not a big thing by our thinking. I mean, taking off your shoes? Yeah, okay, no big deal, no problem. In that time, it might have held a little more significance, though, than it does for us today. Moses, having grown up in Egypt, would have been familiar with the Egyptian custom of priests removing their shoes before serving in the temples. In doing this, it seems Moses acknowledges God as his sovereign. In fact, according to Jewish tradition, the Levites had to remove their shoes before serving, and the priests went barefoot while serving in the sanctuary. Didn't know that before. And there is some scriptural evidence for this. Let's go over to Exodus 30. And I'm going to begin in verse 29. I'm sorry, 19. Exodus 30, 19. I think I'll jump in a little earlier. Verse 18. This is God instructing Moses. You shall also make a laver of bronze, with its base also of bronze, for washing. You shall put it between the tabernacle of meeting and the altar, and you shall put water in it. For Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands and their feet in water from it, when they go into the tabernacle of meeting, or when they come near the altar to minister, to burn an offering made by fire to the Lord, they shall wash with water, lest they die. So shall they wash their hands and their feet, lest they die, and it shall be a statute forever to them, to him and his descendants throughout their generations. Doesn't make much sense to wash your feet if you're putting shoes back on. Besides, if you think about it, the amount of blood that took place in the blood sacrifices, I mean, probably got over everything. So it almost makes sense that they would serve barefoot. Jacob Nacht, in his work, The Symbolism of the Shoe with Special Reference to Jewish Sources, and this was from the Jewish Quarterly Review, he writes, the shoe denotes supreme power and possession. The shoe, thus, is accorded an importance equaling that of the foot. The foot signifies domination. And he cites Psalm 8:6 here. You have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands and have put all things under his feet. And he says, hence the victor puts his foot on the vanquished to symbolize the victory which has been won. And the next example here I'm going to go to is Joshua 10. Beginning in 22, he says, put your feet on the necks of these kings was the order of Joshua to his victorious warriors in order to indicate that the enemy had been defeated for all time. And Joshua 10:22, and this is after the long day of Joshua where the sun stood still so he could vanquish the Amorites, said, then Joshua said, open the mouth of the cave and bring out those five kings to me from the cave. So apparently they had captured these five kings of the Amorites and put them in a cave. And they did so, and brought out those five kings to him from the cave, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon. So it was, when they brought out those kings to Joshua, that Joshua called for all the men of Israel, and he said to the captains of the men of war who went with him, come near and put your feet on the necks of these kings. And they drew near and put their feet on their necks. Then Joshua said to them, do not be afraid nor dismayed. Be strong and of good courage, for thus the Lord will do to all your enemies against whom you fight. Then afterward he executed them. But it was a sign of being vanquished that you put your foot on the necks of your enemies. The foot symbolizes power over something. Therefore, the shoe represents the power that the foot has. You know, we hear in some of the parables about the salt, which wasn't good for seasoning anymore. The only thing it was good for was to be cast out and trodden underfoot. Something being trodden underfoot was thought of to be of little or no value. The ashes of the wicked in Revelation will be trodden underfoot of the righteous. 2 Samuel 15:30, we find out that it was also a sign of mourning. This was at the time of Absalom's rebellion. 2 Samuel 15, verse 30. And David was fleeing Jerusalem. It says, so David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went up, and he had his head covered and went barefoot. And all the people who were with him covered their heads and went up weeping as they went up. This was a sign of mourning. Captives were led away barefoot. It was a sign of being humbled by their captors and their conquerors. In Isaiah 20, we'll look at something quickly here. I'll just begin in verse 1. In the year that Tartan came to Ashdod, when Sargon the king of Assyria sent him, he fought against Ashdod and took it. At the same time, the Lord spoke by Isaiah the son of Amoz, saying, "Go and remove the sackcloth from your body and take your sandals off your feet." And he did so, walking naked and barefoot. Then the Lord said, "Just as my servant Isaiah has walked naked and barefoot 3 years for a sign and a wonder against Egypt and Ethiopia, so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptian as prisoners and the Ethiopians as captives, young and old, naked and barefoot, with their bare backsides uncovered, to the shame of Egypt." This was a shameful thing. Here the word barefoot means unshod or not having shoes. Understandable. If you don't have shoes on your foot, you're barefoot. But I want to go over to Micah 1 because it's got a bit of a different nuance to it. Micah 1 verse 8. This is talking about how God is going to punish. "Therefore I will wail and howl. I will go stripped and naked. I will make a wailing like the jackals and a mourning like the ostriches." The word here, stripped, is the word barefoot. It primarily refers to being naked in the barefoot sense, in the sense of being ashamed. In other words, not so much as not having shoes on, but being barefoot because somebody took your shoes away and you are vanquished. I'll read it to you from Brenton's Septuagint, his translation. "Therefore shall she lament and wail. She shall go barefooted, and being naked she shall make lamentation as that of serpents and mourning as the daughters of sirens." You know, there is a difference. There's a difference. I remember either kindergarten or first grade. It's a long time ago, so it's not that clear anymore. But we were doing a play for our school. I don't remember if parents were going to be involved or not. But it was the song School Days. And the part I had to play, I had to take my shoe and sock off. And when it came to the part of "Your Bashful Barefoot Joe," I was supposed to wave my foot, my bare foot, in front of everybody. To me, this was ghastly. I remember her telling me in practice I had to take my shoe and sock off, and to me it was tantamount to taking my trousers off. I mean, that's how I felt. Now, I ran around at the pool in bare feet all the time. It didn't seem to make any difference. But here, outside of that, I was very embarrassed about it. I mean, it's kind of a silly thing now. But at the time, it really struck me, wow, this is like, why don't I just dance around with no clothes on? Because that's what it seemed to me to be akin to. So there's a difference between not having your shoes on and being barefoot in the naked, embarrassing sense. It also seems that the shoe represented the power one has over his property. Joshua 1:3 says that God is giving the land to Israel. "Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given you, as I said to Moses." And I think maybe that's where this comes from, because you walk around over your property with your feet and with your shoes. So it gives you a sense of, you know, ownership in a symbolic way. And this is from Jacob Nocht again, his work. "A purchase becomes legal when the seller takes off his shoe and hands it over to the buyer. The ceremony indicates the transfer of possession to the new possessor. The same holds true of the redemption of property by one's kinsman and also of transactions of barter. Of course, we can read about this in the book of Ruth. Let's go to Ruth 4. I'm going to start in verse 7. Now back up for reasons that will become obvious. Ruth 4:7. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm anything, one man took off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was a confirmation in Israel. Therefore the close relative said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself." So he took off his sandal. That's how they finalized the sale or transfer of property. They took their sandal off and they gave it to him. Actually, in Ruth here, it kind of leads to another example of how shoes were used symbolically. And I'll begin in verse 3. And, of course, you know the story, how Ruth goes to Boaz and she asks him to take her under his wings, so to speak, be under his authority, and he would redeem her because of being a near kinsman and her husband was dead. So in verse 3, then he said to the close relative, because there was another relative that was closer than Boaz. So the close relative had first dibs on the property and on Ruth. So he said to the close relative, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants and elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me, that I may know, for there is none but you to redeem it, and I am next after you. And he said, I'll redeem it. And then Boaz said, wise man that Boaz was, oh, by the way, on the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. Of course, then he says, well, I can't redeem it for myself because I'll ruin it, my own inheritance. So go ahead, you can redeem it. Because apparently the law of levirate marriage came into play there, where you had to raise up seed to a brother or a near kinsman. And he wasn't willing to do that because it would affect his own inheritance with his own kids. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 25, because that's where it talks about this. And you can clearly see here that this was a shameful thing. It says, Deuteronomy 25:5, if brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out in Israel. That was also a social safety net, because she would have someone to provide for her in her old age. But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak to him. But if he stands firm and says, don't want to take her, don't want her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal removed. Apparently, you did not want to be known in Israel as the house of him who had his sandal removed. This was not a good thing. This was an embarrassing thing. Even to this day, in the Middle East, shoes have a degree of the same kind of significance that we're talking about. Maybe you remember when Iraq fell after Saddam Hussein, and they didn't. Well, they knocked his statue over, but it was, I guess, he wanted it to stay there for a long time, so it was just kind of laying on its side. The Iraqis were throwing shoes at it and beating it with their shoes as symbolic. And also, President George W. Bush had a news conference over there, and an Iraqi journalist threw not one but two shoes at him as a sign of disrespect. You know, it's bad enough having a shoe thrown at you or two shoes, but there it carries a little more weight because of the disrespect involved. It was obviously a slam on him. Shoes have long had that symbolism in that part of the world. Psalm 60, verse 8, says something interesting because and actually, it says it in a later psalm, too. It says the exact same thing. He's talking about treading down the foes of Israel. I'll pick it up in verse 6. God has spoken in his holiness. I will rejoice. I will divide Shechem and measure out the valley of Succoth. Gilead is mine. Manasseh is mine. Ephraim also is the helmet for my head. Judah is my lawgiver. Moab is my washpot. And over Edom I will cast my shoe. Philistia shout in triumph because of me. Over Edom, I will cast my shoe. God's going to figuratively, and then, you know, obviously this is an anthropomorphic thing, is going to throw his shoe over Edom, signifying that Edom is under his authority and sovereignty, symbolizing his dominance over the nation of Edom. So it's likely that Moses putting off his shoes held a great deal more significance for him than it does for us today. It was a sign of submission, appropriate for the moment. Now, what about the idea of holy ground? Well, we know the tabernacle itself was holy. And there appears to be an order of descending glory beginning at the Holy of Holies, the holiest place, radiating out from there. Clearly, the tabernacle area was holy, but the camp also carried a degree of holiness. Leviticus 4 tells us that when they offered a sin offering, because the sin of the person was transferred to the offering, they did not burn it within the confines of the camp. They took the blood into the altar, but the animal itself, the part that wasn't used, was taken outside of the camp and burned, because the camp was holy. Leviticus 13 shows that lepers had to live outside the camp because they were considered unclean. Not sure, I couldn't find out whether someone who was unclean for touching a dead body or whatever, if they had to remain outside the camp till they were purified, then they could come back in the camp. But the camp of Israel, round about the tabernacle, was holy ground. Let's go to Numbers 5. It tells us why. Numbers 5, beginning verse 2. Command the children of Israel that they put out of the camp every leper, everyone who has a discharge, and whoever becomes defiled by a corpse. Okay. You shall put out both male and female. You shall put them outside the camp that they may not defile their camps, in the midst of which I dwell. And the children of Israel did so and put them outside the camp. Just as the Lord spoke to Moses, the children of Israel did. The camp was holy because God dwelt in the midst of it. Zechariah 2:12 kind of extends this a little bit. And the Lord said, I will take possession of Judah as his inheritance in the Holy Land, and will again choose Jerusalem. Jerusalem is certainly known as the Holy City because that's where God's temple was. And this may explain a rather curious story that we read in 2 Kings 5. 2 Kings 5. This is the story of Naaman the leper. And I'll just paraphrase because it gets kind of long. So Naaman's this great commander of Syrian, very high up, and he has leprosy. He has a captive slave girl who's Jewish. And apparently he treated his people well enough that this Jewish girl said, oh, if you would just go to Israel to this prophet, your leprosy problem would be over. He says, well, I don't know. Why not? So he talks to his lord, and his lord says, go ahead. Well, this kind of upset the king of Israel because he thought it might be a ruse to justify an invasion because this man might be insulted. But he goes to Elisha, and Elisha says, go wash 7 times in the Jordan River. And Naaman says, well, the Jordan River, we have great rivers in Syria. Why can't I wash in one of them? But somebody wisely says, well, if he asked you to do that or do a great thing, you would do it. So he says, well, I guess that's true. So he goes, he washes 7 times, his leprosy's gone. He's healed of his leprosy. Where do I want to pick this up? Let's see. So he becomes a believer in the true God because of his healing. It says in verse 16, but he said, as the Lord lives before whom I stand. Oh, I'm sorry. He wanted to give something to Elisha. Elisha said no. In verse 17, so Naaman said, well, then if you don't want any money or great clothing or anything like that, I have a favor to ask. Can you please let your servant be given 2 mule loads of earth? For your servant will no longer offer either burnt offering or sacrifice to other gods, but to the Lord. Verse 18, yet in this thing may the Lord pardon your servant when my master goes into the temple of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand and I bow down in the temple of Rimmon. When I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord please pardon your servant in this thing. Then he said, go in peace. So he took his leave along with 2 mule loads of earth. Why? Because the idea was that God was the God of Israel. It was connected to the land. The land was holy. So if Naaman took some of this holy earth with him, he could properly worship the true God. So he took earth from the nation of Israel, the land of Israel, the holy land, back to Syria with him. So he could worship God, because apparently he couldn't just worship God without some part of the holy ground where God was. Just an interesting mindset. Naaman needed actual earth from Israel in order to feel like he could properly worship the God of Israel. So we know a little more about how the ancients viewed holy ground and the symbolism of the foot and shoe, but I really have yet to answer my question as to why that particular time God asked Moses to remove his shoes when other times God did not seem to require it. Because you would think the same thing would have held true in those other times as well. Well, we might gain some understanding about this if we look at the one other time God had someone remove their shoes in his presence. That would be in Joshua 5. It's toward the end of the chapter in verse 13. And it came to pass, when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or are you for our adversaries? So he said, no, but as commander of the army of the Eternal, I have now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take your sandal off your foot, for the place you stand is holy. And Joshua did so. Now think about this. Joshua spent a lot of time with Moses. He spent a lot of time in God's presence with Moses. In fact, I want to go back to Exodus 33 and read you something briefly. Let's try this again. Exodus 33:7, Moses took his tent and pitched it outside the camp, far from the camp, and called it the Tabernacle of Meeting. And it came to pass that everyone who sought the Lord went out to the Tabernacle of Meeting, which was outside the camp. So it was whenever Moses went out to the tabernacle that all the people rose, and each man stood at his tent door and watched Moses until he had gone into the tabernacle. And it came to pass, when Moses entered the tabernacle, that the pillar of cloud descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle, and the Lord talked with Moses. All the people saw the pillar of the cloud standing at the tabernacle door, and all the people rose and worshipped, each man in his tent door. So the Lord spoke to Moses face to face, as a man speaks to his friend, and he would return to the camp. But his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, did not depart from the tabernacle. Joshua stayed in the tent of meeting. Joshua himself spent a lot of time with God. Surely he was familiar with the protocols when in God's presence, what to do. Yet here, God commands him to remove his shoes because the ground he's standing on was holy. Well, I guess to understand this, we need to read on a little bit in Joshua. Read Joshua 6, because at this point in time, God says to him in verse 2, "And the Lord said to Joshua, 'See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king and the mighty men of valor.'" And then, of course, he goes into all the instructions about how they're going to conquer Jericho. God begins to use Joshua at this point in time for the conquest of the promised land. So you have Moses bringing Israel out of Egypt, and you have Joshua bringing them into the promised land. Now let's look at something in Isaiah 63. Isaiah 63, verse 11. "Then he remembered the days of old, Moses and his people, saying, 'Where is he who brought them up out of the sea with the shepherd of his flock? Where is he who put his Holy Spirit within them, who led them by the right hand of Moses, with his glorious arm dividing the water before, to make for himself an everlasting name?'" Moses was God's right hand. God used Moses here. And there's an even better place in Judges 2 that illustrates this point. Judges 2, verse 1. "Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, 'I led you up from Egypt and brought you into the land which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I would never break my covenant with you.'" Who brought Israel out of Egypt? Moses. No, the angel of the Lord. Who brought Israel into the promised land? Well, Joshua. No, the angel of the Lord did both of those things. It's interesting, just as a quick aside, in verse 7 it says, "So the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel," through Moses and through Joshua, both of them. God used Moses and Joshua in a way that few, if any, in the Old Testament were used. God used them as extensions of himself, instruments of his will to deliver Israel from Egypt and to bring them into the promised land. And in each case, before God begins to use them, each is told to remove his shoes from off his feet. In order for God to use these two men in such a mighty way, they had to remain humble and reverent before God. Putting off their shoes seems to me to mean that they were putting aside their pride and their power to allow God to work his work through them. God cannot use someone who puts their own will before God's. It seems by this act, both men were showing in a symbolic sense that God's will would be their will. They would make God's will their will. They would have no will of their own. So what does this mean for us today? Well, holy ground doesn't mean today what it meant in Moses and Joshua's day. And we don't think of shoes the way they did in any kind of symbolic sense, although, truth be told, they can be a source of pride, you know, in aggrandizing the self if you have, you know, really sharp pair of shoes, you know, 200 pair of Nikes which I would never buy, but some people like that kind of thing. It can be a source of pride, but not in a symbolic way that it was for them. Let's go to John 4. This is the story of the Samaritan woman at the well. Excuse me. So John 4, I'm going to read in, start in verse 19, but we're breaking into the story here. Of course, he tells her all about himself, and she says, well, wow, I think you're a prophet. I perceive, the woman said to him in verse 19, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. And Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. So if holy ground is where the presence of the Lord is, then is there holy ground today? There is. The holy ground today is us. Because Christ has placed his presence in us through the Holy Spirit, the very Spirit of God. Not such a long time ago, there was another person who was born under a death sentence. However, this person was also chosen by God for a purpose. God delivered the person in such a miraculous way that only God can. Who am I talking about now? I'm talking about you, and I'm talking about me. Passing from death to life in Christ is a miraculous thing. God has drawn us to himself in whatever way he chose. I didn't see a burning bush. I doubt that any of you did. If you did, I'd like to talk to you afterward. But he draws us in whatever way he feels will work. I mean, honestly, sometimes I think he drew me by my own pride of wanting to know more than other people. We're wanting to know more prophetic information than other people. But whatever works, he draws you to him, and then he can begin working with you. So he draws us to him in whatever way he chose. And now we stand before God, and he asks us symbolically to remove our shoes. Are we? Are we setting aside our pride and our power to allow God to work in and through us, making us instruments of his will? Extensions of God himself. Moses did. Joshua did. Can we?